On this episode, we explore heart arrhythmias, in particular, the most common culprit, atrial fibrillation. What is it and what causes it? And how is your medical certificate affected when a pilot experiences palpitations and finds out that it's AFib? All on this episode of the Mayo Clinic Clear Approach Podcast, your home for aerospace medicine that matters.
Welcome to this latest version of the podcast. I'm Mitch Nelson.
And I'm Clay Cole, your medical co-pilot, coming to you from Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, where the pattern is clear, the wings are all level, and the AMEs are all above average.
We receive dozens of phone calls from pilots who have experienced an irregular and often rapid heartbeat where the upper chambers of the heart are fibrillating or experiencing excess electrical activity. Sort of like a gas engine with a couple of spark plugs pulled out.
Oh yeah. Atrial fibrillation, often called AFib, is the most common type of treated heart arrhythmia. An arrhythmia is when the heart beats too slowly or too fast or in some sort of irregular way. When a person has AFib, the normal beating in the upper chambers that we refer to as the atria is irregular, and the blood doesn't flow as well as it should from the atria to the lower chambers of the heart that we call the ventricles. AFib may happen in brief periods, we call that paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, or it may be a permanent condition. You know, the CDC estimates that 12.1 million people in the U.S. will have AFib by the year 2030. In 2019, AFib was mentioned on 183,000 death certificates, and it was the underlying cause of death in a little over 25,000 of those deaths. Interestingly, people of European descent are more likely to have AFib than African Americans, and because of the number of AFib cases increases with age, and women generally live longer than men, more women than men actually experience AFib overall. It's an interesting condition, and next we'll chat with a cardiologist with expertise in dealing with abnormal heart rhythms, and then review the aeromedical implications of this condition.
With me today is Dr. Suraj Kappa. He is a board-certified cardiologist with a subspecialty in cardiac electrophysiology. His areas of expertise include treatment for patients with atrial and ventricular arrhythmia, heart failure, and ventricular tachycardia, to name a few. Dr. Kappa, welcome. Tell us about yourself. How long have you been at Mayo Clinic?
Yeah, so I've had a long and storied experience at Mayo. Did part of my training here in the early 2000s, and then I've been a faculty here since 2013.
We see a lot of pilots, and over the years, we've noticed atrial fibrillation, or AFib, is a very common rhythm disturbance that pilots encounter. Why do you think it's so common?
Atrial fibrillation, to be quite frank, is probably the most common type of heart disease that we see in practice today in general. Many people believe in my field that if we all live long enough, all of us will have atrial fibrillation at some point. Just because of the number of insults that occur to our body that might contribute to why atrial fibrillation occurs. So if you take pilots in particular, the constant stress of going up several tens of thousands of feet, sometimes even higher, and then back down again and up again and down again, and even the amount of prolonged sitting might increase the likelihood of atrial fibrillation. But to be honest, the most common cause is just normal aging. The older we get, the more likely we are to have it, because it's kind of like the way our body gets wrinkles. Our heart gets its own wrinkles, and that's what is part of the process by which atrial fibrillation happens.
Well, I think that's a great analogy. We sometimes see clinical notes from cardiologists that refer to rhythm controlled or rate controlled. Can you tell us the difference between that and why is that important?
That's a great question. And it speaks to why I care about atrial fibrillation at all. The fact is, we'll be talking in a little bit about the stroke risk associated with atrial fibrillation. But before we talk about that, the other reason we care about knowing if somebody has atrial fibrillation is because it can make people feel unwell. And there's three reasons it can make people feel unwell. Number one is because of the heart rate. Namely, if your heart rate is going higher than what your body wants, that can make you feel unwell. It's kind of like if you're driving a car and you only want to go 60, and all of a sudden you step lightly on the gas and it goes 100, 110 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you get jerked around. But sometimes, even if somebody's heart rate and atrial fibrillation is under reasonable control, less than 80, 90 beats a minute on average, you can still feel unwell because of the irregularity of when you're in atrial fibrillation. Basically, the time between each beat might be highly variable. And so oftentimes, the most common symptoms are just feeling generally tired, a sense of what we call malaise, or just a general sense of unwellness. And the third reason is because when you're in atrial fibrillation, the upper chambers are beating chaotically and erratically. And because of that, you lose what we call the coordinated atrial kick, the consistent way in which the upper chamber kind of contracts or beats to pump blood from top to bottom. The truth of the matter is, if you look at data from decades ago, there never seemed to be an appreciable difference between what we call rate and rhythm control. Rate control just means, all right, as long as you're in atrial fibrillation, as long as the heart rates are in a reasonable range, not too slow on average, not too fast on average, it's fine to leave you in it. But historically, we would pursue rhythm control in patients who are feeling symptoms because of the atrial fibrillation. In other words, even in the setting of rate control, they would want to actually intervene in order to alleviate those associated symptoms. What's interesting is, as time has gone on and as our technologies have improved to treat atrial fibrillation, and we'll talk about some of those advances later, rhythm control therapies have actually improved to where there's increasingly a signal suggesting that early intervention on atrial fibrillation in patients who might have a low heart function or heart failure, or early in their diagnosis, might actually have improved long-term outcomes, reduced mortality risk, reduced risk of heart failure. So there is increasingly a signal saying that being more aggressive with rhythm control, getting somebody back to normal rhythm and keeping them there, might offer long-term benefits in specific patient populations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's definitely a reason for pilots to listen to their health and to, you know, see their provider when things just aren't really right for them. The FAA often asks medical examiners to make sure that pilots with newly reported AFib get tested for obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA. Is sleep apnea a trigger for AFib? Why does the agency ask for this?
So sleep apnea is a very, very important thing to recognize in general. But particularly in atrial fibrillation, it is well recognized that obstructive sleep apnea is associated with an increased risk of atrial fibrillation. And because of that, and because of the high level of association between the two, and because sleep apnea is something that's treatable through face masks, through sleeping in different positions, or even through lifestyle modifications like weight loss or other efforts, we say it's better to try and treat it, because if you can eliminate a modifiable risk factor, we should. Now, the other reason specific to not only pilots, but commercial drivers and others, is we also know sleep apnea is associated with an increased risk of feeling very sleepy in the daytime. And because of that, that can lead to potential other risks to you, especially if you're responsible for prolonged flying or prolonged driving, and you don't want to be in a position where you're not as alert. And that's another reason specific to pilots in particular that we care about identifying that particular covariant.
And, you know, the FAA requires our examiners to test for coronary disease and other factors using a stress test, and also an echocardiogram for pilots with AFib. What are the most common causes for this? And what do those tests tell you as a cardiologist?
So the important thing we care about when we see any patient who has any sort of abnormal rhythm, not just atrial fibrillation, is making sure there's nothing else going on that we might not have recognized that mm-hmm. might be fixable or something that could lead to long-term harm. I said earlier that historically, when somebody presents with atrial fibrillation, we would generally tell them, look, getting you back to normal rhythm won't necessarily make you live longer. But if atrial fibrillation is just a manifestation of something else going on,
right.
you have what we call mitral valve disease or a narrowed aortic valve or low heart function that was just not recognized on physical examination, then those are things that you would want to treat because they are associated with long-term harm. And even coronary disease or blood vessel blockages, while we typically don't see that as a cause of atrial fibrillation, coronary disease might be relevant to how we choose to treat the atrial fibrillation because there are certain drugs that we cannot use to treat the rhythm when there's blockages in the blood vessels mm-hmm. present. So those are all factors that kind of come into play for us.
And so you mentioned medications. It seems that some pilots are prescribed beta blockers like metoprolol or etanolol, but others may need more potent antiarrhythmics like sotalol, flecainide. How do you decide what to prescribe to keep rhythm in check?
So this is where we go through a shared decision-making approach with the individual. So when we think about how we can intervene on atrial fibrillation, we start oftentimes with the most conservative approach, that which carries the least interim and long-term harm, which is medications like beta blockers, like the ones you named, or even calcium channel blockers. Traditionally, we don't think of those drugs as rhythm control drugs. We usually think of those drugs as preventing the heart rate from getting too high if and when you go into atrial fibrillation. The tricky thing with those drugs is with all medications, they have side effects. One of those side effects is they can also decrease the heart rate when you're in normal rhythm. So if you're going in and out of atrial fibrillation, great. We prevented you from going too fast, but now the other times you're going too slow. So you might have symptoms the other way around. The other set of medications you described, drugs like sotalol and flecainide, and just to name the others, propafenone, dofetilide, dronedarone, and amiodarone.
Okay.
Are all what we call antiarrhythmic drugs. Those are drugs that are purposefully meant to help keep the heart in normal rhythm, to prevent it from flipping into AFib. Now, the reason to pick any one of those drugs is often based on patient-specific factors. So, for example, if somebody has no history of blood vessel blockages, otherwise very healthy, structurally normal heart, flecainide and propafenone are often our initial go-tos. However, if you have a history of a blood vessel blockage, if you have an abnormality in your heart function, we might go to sotalol, which also has a beta blocking effect, so also has that heart rate slowing mm-hmm. effect, or dofetilide. Now, amiodarone is a drug oftentimes people with AFib will hear about, especially if they go to the emergency room with it or someplace else. Today, amiodarone is considered a last line agent, assuming other drugs have failed, because it has a lot of long-term side effect risks. And the truth is, with all of these antiarrhythmic drugs, they do have the potential risk, while they're trying to prevent an abnormal rhythm and keep you in a normal rhythm, they do have a small risk of causing dangerous abnormal rhythms that could actually cause somebody to suddenly pass out. So they need to undergo appropriate monitoring when they're on those drugs, oftentimes a yearly stress test or an EKG and laboratory checks every 6 months.
So when it comes time to deciding on whether a pilot needs, say, anticoagulation, we hear about a CHADS score or a CHADS VAS score. What does this scoring system tell us? And when should pilots expect to be placed on anticoagulants like Coumadin or novel anticoagulants like apixaban or rivaroxaban?
As I said earlier, one of the main reasons we care about knowing if somebody has atrial fibrillation is we know in some patients, they can have a significantly elevated risk of stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the truth is, even if you have no risk factors, you probably do have a little bit of increased risk. But what we're balancing is the risk of stroke against the risk of the medications we might keep you on to prevent that stroke. Because the risk with all these medications, whether it be warfarin or whether it be the newer agents we call DOACs, is the fact that they can increase the risk of bleeding. So we're balancing increased risk of bleeding against increased risk of stroke. So when we make a decision to put somebody on a blood thinner, we're basing it on what risk factors they have. Those risk factors are used by the scores you've mentioned. Historically, the simplified scoring system was something called the CHADS-2 score. It considered whether you have heart failure, hypertension, how old you are, diabetes, or a history of stroke. But then with more research, people came to understand that that score was not nuanced enough. They were not considering other patient-specific variables, like if they have blood vessel disease, like blood vessel blockages in their heart arteries, or the fact that the older you get, the higher risk you are. If you're 75, you're actually higher risk for stroke than if you're 65. So that's what that CHADS-VASc score came into play with. Now, there were new guidelines put in place last year, because what we've come to realize even beyond the CHADS-VASc score is that there are other patient-specific variables that we have not really considered as well. If somebody has what we call chronic kidney disease or slightly poor kidney function, or other variables that actually might modify somebody's patient-specific risk for stroke, okay, which we need to consider putting somebody on a medication. Now, answering the second part of what you were asking, typically nowadays we favor the DOACs when we're treating for stroke prevention. The reason being that warfarin, oftentimes you're kind of chasing your tail, so to speak.
Right.
You're basically saying, okay, let me just keep testing you to make sure you're staying in what we call therapeutic range. Mm-hmm. And it can be hard to achieve that. So because of that, these newer medications that are just the same dose in every individual based on what their kidney function is, based on what their age is, you don't have to get repeated blood checks. You don't have to watch what you eat. You don't have to watch what other medications you're on because they're not affected by those, have come into play. Now, the negative is they are more costly. You know, they're still under patent. Right. They're still in that entire process. So they are more expensive, but the actual risk associated with them of major bleeding is less, and they have equivalent to better efficacy in preventing stroke.
You know, and alternatively, we frequently see pilots who undergo cardiac ablation for atrial fibrillation. When is that procedure indicated?
When we've established that we want to achieve rhythm control, that we want to get somebody back in normal rhythm and keep them there, that's where we start talking about whether or not we should do an ablation. Ablation, if you, again, go back even 5-10 years ago, it used to be a second line strategy. We would tell people, try a drug. If the drug fails, let's go to ablation. What's interesting is with significant improvements in the technology and in the efficacy of these technologies and in safety, it's now actually considered first line.
Okay.
So it's actually changed in guidelines actually as of December 2023 to saying that in a patient, say, with symptomatic atrial fibrillation, they go in and out of it on their own, ablation could be considered an upfront therapy to be done first line. And that's in part because of the improvements in these technologies. Because again, if you go back even 5 years ago, many of these atrial fibrillation ablation procedures would take 4, 5, 6 hours under general anesthesia. With newer technologies, they're getting to be done within 30 minutes to an hour. So okay, it's significantly different than what we've experienced going back to several years ago.
And are pilots seeing immediate results from this procedure?
So the tricky thing with ablation is it's also not a cure-all.
Okay.
It's not a guarantee. The way we talk to patients when they're having an ablation is that, look, our goal is to isolate or eliminate the triggers that drive atrial fibrillation. What we do is we essentially create a moat, like creating a moat around a castle, around these structures called the pulmonary veins. Because you don't really want to kind of burn or cauterize or injure the inside of the veins. You kind of create that moat around it. You don't want to blow up the castle to save the castle. So because of that, when you create that moat, if even one lesion or one little area heals up, it's like leaving a drawbridge down. The army can still come through.
Gotcha.
So for the same principle, people can develop recurrences of atrial fibrillation just because of that. Also, in the first 3 months after any ablation, it's not uncommon to go in and out of AFib just because of what we did to you. Because the reality is, it's kind of like if you had ankle surgery on a broken ankle, you expect pain in your ankle for a couple months. Same way, your heart will still have a tendency to want to go in and out of atrial fibrillation for those first couple of months, but then should settle out after that.
And for pilots that have had this procedure, the FAA asks, you know, for a 6-week downtime before applying for their medical certificate, what kind of complications do you see with ablations? And, you know, what about the safety for the pilot?
Overall safety, we estimate, in terms of complication rates, mm-hmm. anything around 3%. The most common complication is just bleeding in the area of the groin where we put these IV lines. And the reality is that will go away after 2 weeks or so in terms of any risk there. But we tell people to avoid heavy lifting for just like around a 10 to 14 day period, just to let those groins heal up and not be at risk of developing what we call a hematoma or a large bruise under the skin. More serious risks that we'd worry about, like causing a stroke from the procedure, causing injury to a structure we call the esophagus, which sits right behind the area of the heart we're primarily targeting, injuring a nerve that controls something called our diaphragm, which is our kind of main muscle for breathing. Those are theoretical complications of the procedure that have been seen. Luckily, they're not very common. Mm-hmm. You know, any one of these is far less than 1%, but obviously they could be devastating if they happen. Some of those complications will happen immediately. Like if you have a stroke from the procedure, if you have an injury to that nerve, you should see it right away. But some injuries, like the esophageal injury we discussed, can be seen up to 4 or 5 weeks after the procedure, which is why that 6-week platform comes into play, just to give them the maximum time to fully heal. So we know when they're isolated up in the air, potentially doing a transatlantic flight, right. they're not going to be at any risk of something bad happening from that procedure.
Right. And that's not the place to have something like that occur. Some pilots, it's required for them to have an halter monitor or an event recorder. Can you tell us more about the difference between those devices and what are they monitoring?
The goal of any device we use in any rhythm disorder, really, is to get an electrocardiographic recording of the rhythm itself. For example, when I do a Holter monitor or an ambulatory monitor that you can wear for many days, the goal is two things. To look for arrhythmias that might happen over that time frame, like you have runs of atrial fibrillation, or say you're in atrial fibrillation all the time, understanding what the average heart rate when you're in atrial fibrillation actually is, to make sure there's adequate rate control if you're trying to go after that approach. An event monitor is a little bit different. An event monitor is intermittent capturing of what's going on. So that's like saying, hey, I know I just had this ablation, but I'm having this funny feeling every other day. We want to know what's going on at that time. So then you can have an event recorder that records the event at that time. What's the negative? It's not full disclosure monitoring. You take 30 seconds to pull it out of your pocket and, you know, hit the button. That's not going to be reflective of what happened in that moment. Now, there are newer ways of achieving monitoring that are important to recognize that a lot of physicians might actually have their patients use. Number one is actually something like a watch. There's also a device you can keep in your pocket, which you can record an ECG on, and it sends to your phone, to your smartphone, and it's actually a clinical grade ECG, and you can actually record yourself with that. And sometimes people will put what we call a loop recorder in, which is a hairpin sized device that sits just underneath the skin that can stay in place and record your rhythm for up to 3 years.
So there's plenty of opportunities and devices out there for people who need to or want to monitor for the AFib. You had mentioned cardiac ablations as becoming more of an earlier approach to heart arrhythmias. Are there any other procedures, drugs, or breakthroughs for the treatment of atrial arrhythmias at this time?
So there actually are. And I'll kind of go through some of the main ones. And I would say the biggest one actually is lifestyle modification. What we've come to recognize is somebody's body mass index is above 27. If they lose 10% of their body weight and they improve their fitness by kind of one grade on a treadmill test, in about 40% of people, the AFib can go away. In fact, this is data that's been coming out of Australia for almost a decade now, such that it's actually made it into our guidelines to say that class one indicated you have to do it is if somebody has things that you can modify lifestyle-wise, alcohol intake, weight loss, exercise, fitness, things like that, those are things you can intervene on that if you don't, any other therapy might not work. Other areas of evolution, medications are kind of where they've been for a while now. So we haven't really seen much on the forefront of medication developments. But from an ablation approach, we have seen significant changes, especially within the last 4 months. There's a new technique called pulse field ablation, which is a novel way of isolating those veins. And it's been under study for over 20 years, but it's finally come into our clinical FDA-approved approach. And what that technology does is it actually lets us make the procedure much faster and actually potentially safer, because some of the risks I mentioned before, like the esophageal risk and the phrenic risk, are eliminated by that device. Now, we're still in the early phases of understanding how that technology will work in the long term, what other new risks might exist with it, but it's highly suggestive of being kind of a groundbreaking paradigm change in what we do.
Let's discuss what happens if you, as a pilot, develop atrial fibrillation. Now, although the FAA physicians must review your case if AFib is a new diagnosis, the process of special issuance renewals, once the issue has been reported, is straightforward and relatively easy. So for first-time reports, your aviation medical examiner must defer the application. So it's important that all the supporting material is attached electronically to your medical application at that time in order to move your case through the system as rapidly as possible. This will include all notes from your treating cardiologist and your primary care provider, all testing results such as an echocardiogram, a Holter monitor, lab reports, and you should enclose a non-valvular atrial fibrillation status summary that should be completed by your cardiologist for an overview of your arrhythmia, and you should bring that with you to your AME visit. Now, once you receive a waiver from the FAA, referred to as a special issuance authorization, you will be granted a time-limited certificate, typically for 12 calendar months. So, for example, if you had an examination in April 2024, your certificate would be valid through April 30th, 2025. Keep in mind that your AME may reissue your Airman Medical Certificate under the provisions of the authorization that you received if you provide the following. First, you need to bring the special issuance letter with you to your AME. Next, you'll need to have a 24-hour cardiac monitor, often referred to as a Holter monitor, performed within the prior 90 days. Now, 90 days is important because the FAA defines 90 days as being current for the purposes of data being attached to your medical application form. You bring that with you at the time of your flight physical, even if the findings are normal on the Holter monitor study. And that study itself should include a one-page computerized report and representative full-scale multi-lead ECG tracings. Your cardiologist should complete a non-valvular atrial fibrillation status summary, which is a form that you can get from the FAA website. Provide that to the cardiologist because many of those specialists don't actually speak airplane and may or may not be familiar with that form. It will require them to fill out some basic information about your atrial fibrillation and your current clinical status. But once you have that, you simply bring that to your aviation medical examiner. On that form, it will show the FAA that there's been no evidence of or suspicion of stroke, a TIA, or other thromboembolic event from the time that you first reported atrial fibrillation. It also needs to show that your heart rate is generally well controlled on a cardiac monitor by cardiologist interpretation and how that arrhythmia is actually being managed. So as you recall, there are different types of medications or procedures that can be performed in order to manage atrial fibrillation. Now, again, when your CHADS VASC score, remember we covered that with Dr. Kappa, is greater than 2, you must verify at that time that you're taking an anticoagulant. So that means if you're more than 70 years of age, the FAA will expect that you're on a blood thinner because the risk of stroke is more significant based on those prediction equations. Now, keep in mind, your AME would need to defer to the Aeromedical Certification Division or the Regional Flight Surgeon's Office if you've had a left atrial appendage occlusion, also referred to as a Watchman procedure, or if you've developed a new cardiac condition. It would also need to be deferred again if there'd been an interval definitive or suspicious thromboembolic event, such as a blood clot in the leg or maybe a blood clot on the lung, often referred to as a pulmonary embolism. It would also need to be deferred if your cardiologist noted a questionable or even a poor bit of rate control. So, for example, if the average heart rate is greater than 100, or if your non-exercise maximum heart rate is greater than 120 beats per minute, or If during the Holter monitor study, there is an actual pause of greater than 3 seconds, these are all things that the FAA needs to sort out further. Now, if there's evidence that you'd have developed symptoms or the rate or rhythms are not well controlled, the agency will also need to review those cases as well. Obviously, if you've had interval bleeding that requires medical intervention, that would also need further evaluation. So if you end up undergoing an ablation procedure, keep in mind that a stand-down time of 6 weeks is required by the FAA, at which point you would still need to undergo the cardiac monitor testing and have a current update from your treating cardiologist. Now, even though AFib is a commonly encountered condition, it really shouldn't keep you from flying if you're receiving the standard of care for this rhythm disturbance. Thanks for joining us today on the podcast, and we look forward to having you join us on future episodes. Remember that if you encounter a health-related question pertaining to your aeromedical certification, you can reach our Clear Approach website at clearapproach.mayoclinic.org for an online consultation. And send your comments and suggestions for future podcasts to clearapproach@mayo.edu. Soft landings and make it a great day.